Today, it's great to have Katie Milkman on the podcast. Dr. Milkman is an award-winning behavioral scientist and the James G. Dinan Professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. She hosts Charles Schwab's popular behavioral economics podcast, Choiceology, and is the co-founder and co-director of the Behavior Change for Good initiative. She has worked with or advised dozens of organizations on how to spur positive change, including Google, the U.S. Department of Defense, the American Red Cross, 24 Hour Fitness, Walmart, and Morningstar. Her research is regularly featured in major media outlets such as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and NPR. Dr. Milkman, so great to chat with you today.
So great to chat with you. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. I've been wanting to talk to you for quite some time. So we have a mutual friend, Angela Duckworth, mutual colleague. And she
Yes, we do.
And she described you as a master of human nature. she says that you figured out how to align your action with your goals and dreams. Do you agree with that?
No. We both know that Angela is much too kind. And I think she, anyway, there are
she
some
is,
areas
but in this case,
I,
she may be right. In this case, I think she may be right. What is that? So what does
that
mean?
I think that's unlikely.
Well, let me start off by asking you, what would that even mean to, align one's actions with their goals and dreams? What would that look like? And I do think you do it, by the way.
That's very kind of you to say. I suspect what Angela was talking about is I think she and I both share a tenacity. She might even call it grit that drives us. And we, I think, both have defined in the last decade very clearly what it is we hope to achieve with our careers and our lives. And we're both pretty focused on getting there. So I would say, I suspect she wrote that because, you know, we spend a lot of time together working towards those goals. She knows exactly what my purpose is. Yeah. And, when you know someone that well, and when you see the way that they devote themselves to something, I think that can make you excited. And I think she wrote lovely things.
So why is change so hard? That's the million-dollar question. You have an interesting spin on it, you know, and arguing that you just haven't found the right strategy if you're finding it hard. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was trying to figure out sort of what is the overarching theme of all of this work that I've been doing over the last two decades, roughly, trying to figure out what creates change and what creates durable change. The one thing that really jumped out at me is that there are systematic barriers to change. They differ depending on what kind of change you're looking to make. So whether it's that you're struggling to get started, whether it's that, you know, there's just a temptation you can't resist over and over again, maybe not to get off the couch when you want to go to the gym or to spend on things when you should be saving, to yell at someone when you should be patient. So there's temptations, there's inertia, sort of bad habits, laziness. I'd put all into that bucket, and laziness is, you know, too unkind of a term for the efficiency that we all have when we say I'm going to take the path of least resistance, but that's our common term for it. So there are all these different things, and they trip us up in different parts of our lives. And I've seen so many times individuals and organizations that are trying to create change make the mistake of thinking there's sort of a one-size-fits-all solution that they can grab off of a prepackaged, you know, off-the-shelf prepackaged, and it's going to work for them without thinking deeply about what is the barrier to change in this situation. Is this person not taking their medication regularly because they forget, or is it because, you know, there's a nasty side effect, and even though it's good for them in the long run and that outweighs the discomfort they'll experience, if you are sort of an optimizer, if you give into temptation, you might choose not to take that medication. And depending on which of those is the problem, you need a really different solution. So that's kind of the big takeaway I've had, is too often people neglect to think carefully what is the obstacle, and instead they reach for the one size fits all. And that's a mistake. We can do much better if we're actually suiting our solutions to the challenge that we're facing.
Yeah. And another way you put it is match your approach to your opponent, you know, with the Andre Agassi example that you used. So yes. Who are my opponents? According to you, they're impulsivity, procrastination, forgetfulness, laziness, confidence, and conformity. Now, is that overconfidence?
And getting started. Yeah. Also getting started.
And getting started. Yes, that's funny that I left that one out. By confidence, you mean overconfidence, right? Like, is it okay to have a little bit of confidence?
I actually don't mean overconfidence. I know most behavioral scientists get very excited about overconfidence, and I write about that a little bit. And I know you had Danny Kahneman recently on the podcast, mm-hmm. who's such a wonderful scientist and guest, and has, I think, on the record proclaimed overconfidence to be the biggest problem with human nature, the one that he would most like to correct. Mm-hmm. But despite that, which I acknowledge in my book, I actually mean underconfidence as a barrier to change. So mm-hmm. Overconfidence has all sorts of problems, and it can relate to change issues too, right? If you're overconfident that you'll be able to just sort of push through and you don't develop strategies to overcome some of these challenges, that can be a major barrier. But another barrier is you don't believe you can. So you lack the self-efficacy, and that can be really important as well. So that's what I focus a chapter on in the book.
Okay. Let's get into some others, goodies. Conformity is an interesting goodie because, as a creativity researcher, I often talk about how conformity is the enemy to creativity, you know? How can it also be an obstacle standing between you and success? I mean, use the word success, you know, by the way, I want to know what you even mean by success.
I really just mean achieving whatever goal you set out to achieve. Okay. That's blocked by internal barriers, right? And like really importantly, right, I'm not talking about the things, this book is not about the societal obstacles that can stand in our way. It's about, you know, imagine a world, well, you don't have to imagine a world. The world has put up other obstacles too. This book will help with the obstacles that are inside you. I unfortunately don't have the solutions for all the world's obstacles. But when it comes to conformity, the barrier there is really that our peers shape our decisions more than we appreciate. That, you know, your college roommate, whether you're randomly assigned to a roommate who did well on the verbal SATs, turns out to predict your grades. And so there's the peer groups you surround yourself with, they help us define what's normal. And we think, oh, you know, this is how much I should study, or this is how much money I should make, or this is how much I should give to charity, or how hard I should work, or how fit I should be. And so that can be a barrier if your peer group is not aligned with your goals. And if they're sending you the message that people like you can't achieve the kinds of things you want to achieve. So that's what I mean really when I say conformity can be a barrier to change.
Good, good, good. I like this. Okay, laziness. Let's talk about laziness.
Let's talk about laziness. Oh, man. I do feel like that could be a book. That's a title to a book. Let's talk about laziness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a big one for me during COVID, is that it's so easy to be lazy when you're at home all day long.
It's easy all the time to be lazy, but you're right. It's totally easier now because, and partly because there's not as much social pressure not to be lazy, and there's where are you meant to be? Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a big barrier. You know, I have to say that I have a lot of respect for the design of the operating system we've got up here that, prioritizes taking the path of least resistance and being a bit lazy. You know, it's very efficient and it makes a lot of sense, but it can be a barrier to change when the path of least resistance is not the one that's going to get you whatever it is you hope to achieve. So, what I suggest in the book or talk about in the book is sort of two strategies. One is, I think, you know, has been written about really extensively. It's not all that novel. In fact, my editor at one point was like, does this really have to be in the book? It's so everybody knows it. And I was like, I don't care. I want everything in this book that's useful. And this is really useful. So the first one is just setting defaults wisely, right? So it's been talked about a lot. It's probably the number one trick in the behavioral scientist's handbook for changing behavior, right? If you default people, so when they join a new employer, they're automatically saving for retirement and they have to do nothing. Magically, about 40% more people save. And you can set defaults for yourself or other people that are wise and lead to better choices, including, you know, stocking your fridge with healthy food. So the default snack is something that's good for you.
Radical idea.
Right. Yeah. Or, you know, if you spend too much time on social media like me, you know, make sure that your default websites and so on are maybe the New York Times or your work email as opposed to Twitter or Facebook. So there's all different ways we can set defaults that are useful and productive. So that's one way we can harness laziness, because then the path of least resistance, the thing that happens if you don't lift a finger, is the thing that's sort of in your long-term best interest. But then the second answer, which I think is a little bit more useful, and again, a lot has been written on it, but I hopefully have some new things to say, is through habit. So being deliberate about forming habits, because in a sense, those are sort of the default settings for the behaviors that require a little bit of effort and volition, but not a lot, and sort of that are repeated. And so thinking about how can we use what's known from research on animals, from research on people, to build habits that are lasting is a big bonus. And I'm happy to get into that, but let me pause and give you a chance to get a word in edgewise.
No, I mean, I would like you to elaborate on that a bit, actually. I mean, I mean, this is my, I'm interviewing you here. So
Go on. But you have all sorts of fascinating ideas, and I want to make sure that I'm giving you space to add them.
Well, okay. Who knows? Maybe I can be on Choiceology someday. But
I would love that. That would be amazing.
But
our show is really different.
Yeah.
Our show is really different.
Yeah. But and no pressure, of course. But I'm saying, but for now, you're the star. So yeah, go on.
Are you telling me I'm trying to be the host? Okay, fair enough.
I'll try not to do that.
Okay, so habits. So the really basic stuff about habits that's been written about extensively in books like, you know, Atomic Habits and The Power of Habit, it's right. And we know, which is like, you know, what's the cue that triggers the behavior that then creates a reward and then repeat. And if you can build that cycle and do it enough times, and nobody knows the magic number of times, by the way, that's like a hot debate. I'm working on a paper about that right now, but it's a lot of times. Yeah. Then you can start to put something basically on autopilot so that it becomes like second nature. You're not really deliberating. You're just acting. Oh, like I make the coffee in the morning without even thinking about it. I shampoo my hair without thinking that I can't remember, did I shampoo my hair or not? Cause I wasn't even paying attention. Right. So that's sort of the basic process for forming habits. What I think is a bit more interesting is something I read about called The Power of Elastic Habits. And this is based on some research I did at Google with a couple thousand of their employees who wanted to form exercise habits. And we teamed up to try to figure out if we could develop a better methodology for habit formation. Like what technique could we use to get people to form stickier habits? And we ran a test and we had two different ideas. And I'm actually going to ask you your intuition on this because I'm really curious. So we had two strategies that we were going to use. Strategy one was we just sort of use the old fashioned, like reward people for repeating the behavior. So people make a plan. They tell us the ideal time for them to work out each day at the Google campus gym. And we tell them we're going to send you a reminder at that time. And then we tell them if you work out any time that day, you're going to get paid a few dollars. Okay, so that's group one. Group two, same startup. So you tell us the time you prefer to work out. We're going to send you a reminder right before that time, encourage you to do it. And you'll also get paid, but you'll only get paid if you start your workout within the two-hour window you define as best for you. And both of these programs last for a month. And at the end of the month, they're over. And what we really care about is what happens next. And we actually did it. We randomized the amount of money in both groups that we were rewarding people with so that we wanted to isolate basically two types of people who had gone to the gym at the same frequency, but in different ways. One group had gone basically fairly consistently, really at the same time of day, almost always. And the other group who had more variability in when they went. And the question was, which group would then have the more durable habit? The variable visitors or not? Yeah.
I think that probably the first one showed the better effect, even though the intuition from people might be that the second one would be correct. Am I correct?
Tell me why you think that is.
Is it the complete opposite?
Well, I don't even remember which one I said first.
the consistent one was the first one.
You think that did better?
I think you probably got a better effect there.
So that's what we thought. That's what 77% of psychologists we surveyed predicted.
So at least I'm in the 77%.
You're totally normal. And like me, I was like, let's show that this sort of really consistency, this routinization is the key to habit. And it, you know, there's theories of that, but it hadn't been tested. And we said, like, let's turn it into an intervention because we knew it correlates, right? People who have really consistent, like, pill taking routines they do at the same time of day or exercise tend to exercise more, take their medicines more. So we thought, like, can we convert it into a, okay, so we were wrong. Both of us were wrong. But here's why I think it's really interesting. We weren't totally wrong. So the people who were rewarded and built this habit around going at exactly the same time, once the reward period ends, they do actually go a bit more at that time. So they've formed something of a habit around that sort of sticky, magical time that they'd told us was best for them. But the thing is, if they don't go at that time, they don't go at all. Mm. So whereas the other group, they go a little bit less consistently at that sort of magic time. But if they miss that time, they still get to the gym at a higher rate. And net, they go more often, right? So one group, I call them sort of like rigid instead of routine, right? It's 8 a.m. or bust. And the other group has figured out, like, you know, 8 a.m. is my best time. I'll mostly go then. But if I miss 8 a.m., I'll go at 5 p.m. And so that ends up being a more stable and consistent. It may not be sort of like the automaticity of habit that actually we typically think of that we've built, rather than more of a sort of like no matter what routine that I make a priority to figure out a way to fit this into my day, and I've learned different ways to do it, but that turns out to be what's more robust. So anyway, that was kind of one of my favorite projects I worked on because it was such a surprising result. And I think it's really an important insight in general about change, because I think we tend to underappreciate how hard it will be to sort of stay on that perfect path. And we don't build in enough flexibility for the obstacles that will get thrown at us. And when we do build flexibility in various ways, and there's other ways I talk about flexibility and how important that can be in the book, but this is one way, that kind of flexibility actually turns out to make us stronger and have more robust habits.
Nice, nice. I should have gone with my gut, because my gut did say number two. I was, sometimes when you have these illusionists, like these magicians, you overthink it. You're like, oh, is it this hand or this hand? And you're like,
I didn't even remember what one and two were. I was like, wait, did I give them numbers?
That's true.
Which was which? I was so into the example.
But that's super interesting. So how does this relate to, as you talk about in your book, overcoming flaking out? You know, because it's so easy to flake out, right? I mean, it's just a matter of like a squirrel. and then you forget that you had a whole thing lined up to go to the gym.
I didn't know you knew me so well. We've only talked a couple of times. How do you know so much
about
me? About
myself, but that means we must have things in common. But yeah.
It's
so easy.
So this is... Yeah. So the flake out is this really different challenge, but really, this is another thing that I think we tend to underestimate. People tend to think they won't need reminders, for instance, and undervalue them. And one study that I ran with Todd Rogers, we like offered people the opportunity to pay for reminders for something that would be lucrative. And then they were like, oh, I got it. I'll remember it. And then if they had just paid for the small fee for the reminder, they would have made more money because they would have remembered to do the lucrative thing. So reminders are really important, and we flake out a lot because we forget. But you can't always time a reminder perfectly. And research actually shows that if a reminder doesn't arrive like right at the minute when you need to do something, it's pretty useless. So there's this study I absolutely love that involved valets giving people their cars back after they're like leaving a hotel, and they were reminding people to buckle up. And there's a control condition that gets no reminder. And then there's a basic reminder condition where the valet says, hey, don't forget to buckle up when they're dashing off to get your car. So like 5 minutes roughly before you're actually going to get in the car and be able to put your seatbelt on. And then finally, there's a third valet group that a third experimental group where the valet tells you right as they bring the car back to you, like 2 seconds before you're going to step into it, remember to buckle up. And the reminder that comes 2 seconds before you can act on it has this huge effect, like 85% of people buckle up in that condition. But the other two conditions basically look the same. Only about half of people buckle up, because 4 minutes is enough time for you to completely forget what it was you intended to do. That there's like, you know, it's important to know that. And if you can schedule timely reminders, like I live by my calendar, I suspect you do too, and technology can help. Great. That's the solution to flake out. But often we can't, because not everything in life is like a time. Sometimes it's like, oh, when I'm next at this place, I need to remember to do this thing. Or when I next talk to this person, I need to remember to say this thing. And I don't know when that will happen. And for those things, or when I'm at the doctor's office, there are all sorts of things where if we could figure out how to embed our plans more firmly in memory, we could make more progress. And so I wrote about work by folks we both know, Peter Golwitzer being sort of the lead on it at NYU, who's done all this research on the power of, I call them planning prompts. He calls them implementation intentions, but he's brilliant. Implementation intentions are brilliant. I find planning prompts a little bit easier to remember as in terms of terminology. The basic idea is that if you make exactly. Easier to implement. If you make a concrete plan that has a trigger cue, so not like I will practice Spanish on Duolingo more because I want to learn Spanish, but rather I will practice Spanish on Duolingo every evening at 6 p.m. when I get home from work. Now you have a trigger, and that moment triggers, this is what I'm supposed to be doing now. So it's embedded in memory, associated with a cue. You also have other things going on, right? Like commitment and consistency to this very specific rather than vague plan. There's many benefits of implementation intentions, or planning prompts, but they also can help with flake out. So that's another thing I focus on. And I could sort of go on more, but those are sort of a couple of the key things that I think are tools behavioral science can offer that help a lot with this.
Many an implementation plan has gone boom. we can have like the best implementation plans in the world and still get distracted at any moment. Absolutely. Safeguarding against that seems to be just as important as having the implementation plan itself.
Yeah. Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And the chapter on procrastination, I think in many ways sort of addresses those issues, because it talks a lot about commitment devices, which is basically creating teeth when you make a plan or have a goal or commitment, so that when that moment comes, if you don't follow through, there's some consequence that you have set up, and in order to ensure you won't procrastinate if you don't want to. So I do think, you know, there's a lot of things that work together in the book, even though they sometimes attack different challenges. Often those challenges are known to come in pairs or sets.
For sure. Did you say something about teeth? Did I hear you right?
I did say something about teeth. I'll also say I have teeth on the mind because my 5-year-old lost his second baby tooth this morning. So it could be why.
Congratulations. I remember when I lost mine.
Yes, right. It's such a salient thing. He lost his first one earlier this week and second one today. They go in pairs. Speaking of things going in pairs or sets. Anyway, yes, I did say teeth, probably because I was primed to be thinking about teeth. But by teeth, I mean some consequence, right? So if you say like, oh, I'm going to try to achieve this goal, or I'm going to try to follow through on this plan, and you wanted, and that's all, there are no teeth, because if you fail to follow through, you know, when the moment comes, you let it pass. You're like, well, I said I'd practice on Duolingo tonight at 6 p.m., but really I feel like putting on Bridgerton. So if that happens, right, there's no consequence, except maybe you feel a little guilty, but commitment devices are a tool you can use to create consequences or teeth, so that if you want to make sure you won't watch Bridgerton at 6 p.m., you can set up some sort of constraints that prevent your future self from slipping and making a bad decision. So you could do something like make a cash commitment. Like you could literally put money on the line that will be sent to a charity you hate, and define a referee who will tell your commitment device organization. There's a number of different companies that offer these sorts of devices online. You can have a referee then report back and say, you know, Scott watched Bridgerton. He didn't. And you know, you're going to be called out. And so you're going to lose $100. And so that can make it so that the plan has teeth and you're going to feel like, okay, I really need to sit down and do my Duolingo practice or else I'm going to spend $100 on supporting a cause that I hate.
You know, I never heard that expression before, so I'm glad I double clicked on it. As Angela Duckworth uses, she's just, can we double click on that? She always says that. But yeah. So I'm stealing an Angela quote right now, but or phrase.
There are a lot of good ones.
Yeah, there are. So not having teeth is like not dealing with the consequences. Is that right?
That's right. Okay. That's exactly right.
I'm
going
to use that. I'm going to use that now. Teeth are consequences.
Teeth are consequences.
I get it. I get now. Now I get it. I didn't get it 5 minutes ago, but now I get it. Okay. In your book, another aspect I really found really resonated with me was this idea of the importance of timing, and how a fresh start can be like such a great motivator for 2 seconds.
Right, for 2 seconds, which is why it's the first chapter. And there's a bunch of
this is
chapters.
So me. This is so me. I get so excited about something. I'm like, oh my God. And then forever, I'm gone. Blah, blah. And then like 5 minutes later, I'm like, wait, what? I forgot about it.
And you're back to flake out. See, they come in sets. come in sets.
Good to know I'm not alone. So what are some other kind of fresh starts? And how can we even create our own fresh start, even if it doesn't coincide with a new year, new job, or new relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so the research that you're referring to is was actually inspired by, I talked about Google already, but I'm going to talk about Google again. I've worked with Google a bit. I went and visited Google. This was before I ran that gym study. I went to a conference. I was sharing some of my research on how you could encourage behavior change. And I got this great question from a leader of their human resources, one of their human resources teams, who said, okay, totally sold that we should be providing these kinds of tools that would be helpful and allow employees to change. But like when? When should we deploy them? Is there some good time? Are people more open to change at some times than others? And that's what set me off on this path where I started studying how timing can be really important and uncovered this connection between moments that feel like new beginnings on the calendar from the start of a new year or new week or new month, celebration of a birthday. Those are the kinds of things that I have primarily studied. But we've also found that you can actually highlight certain dates and you can make people more attracted to starting a fresh set of goals on those dates. So if you, for instance, label the first day of spring on the calendar as the first day of spring instead of the third Thursday in March, and then say, you know, pick a date on this calendar, when would you most like to start pursuing a goal? It's much more attractive when people recognize it as the first day of spring. Same with sort of pointing out that a month is when your birthday will take place. Say, do you want to do it after your birthday is more attractive than say, I don't know when your birthday is, but let's say it's February like mine, and saying, do you want to do this next February? Or even, I don't even know how many months from now February is, because 10 months from now, roughly.
It all runs together. Yeah.
It does all run together. These moments both naturally attract us as moments when we're more likely to, for instance, set a goal on a goal setting website, go to the gym at a higher rate. We're more likely to search for the term diet on Google. And there are also moments that if we highlight for people, especially the ones that are subtler, that feel like new beginnings, we can see that there's an attractor effect and people are more willing to, for instance, sign up for a 401k when they're invited to start saving following their upcoming birthday or following the start of spring, rather than just labeling that date as however far off it is in the future. So there's other fresh starts too. Those are the ones I find most interesting because they're purely psychological. They're just in our head. They're sort of related to this concept of time we have, where like we think of our life in chapters, and that new beginning makes us feel like we have a fresh start and a transition. But they can be more powerful if it's not purely psychological, if you also have literally some kind of clean slate, because you say start a new job or move to a new house, and some of the routines or the cues that were maybe associated with not such great habits or patterns are gone. Like, oh, the Dunkin' Donuts where I picked up my unhealthy breakfast every morning on the way to my office. Well, that's no longer part of my routine because I'm going to a new office. So not only do you then have sort of the psychological fresh start, but you actually may have a tabula rasa to work from when it comes to things like resisting temptation and building better patterns of behavior.
Totally. Yeah, it's like it's arbitrary, like the day after my birthday has no intrinsic meaning. But actually, this happens to me every time I do my laundry.
You have a fresh start every time you do your laundry.
For some
You're
reason.
Very fresh start prone.
No, I just don't do my laundry that often.
You're like, I only do it once a week. Well, Mondays are one of the strongest fresh starts in every data set we look at, even though they're frequent. So it's clear that like... It doesn't have to be a really low frequency event to give you some sense of renewal and like, okay, exactly. I've got this. Let me step back. I'm going to do better this time. That was last week. Last week I blew it, but I'm gonna have a good week this week.
Well, can we even like, what if we had like a Zen mindfulness person here in this conversation? Wouldn't they say like every time I return to my breath, I start anew? I mean, this is what they say in my mindfulness classes, you know?
Totally.
So why not even
so
at the most
religions have this.
Yeah. The most dramatic level, you know, this, because like if I listen to these meditation apps, like, you know, like Sam Harris would be like, return to your breath and start again, you know, and as, I feel like that, you know, kind of relates to what you're saying.
No, absolutely. I think it really does. I really do think that fresh starts are built into so many religious practices. Mm-hmm. I sort of started seeing it everywhere when I started studying this, mm-hmm. from, you know, really obvious examples like Easter and Yom Kippur to like subtler maybe examples like ceremonies where you're absolved of sin, or where you, you know, repent and then you're given forgiveness. Those are also really fresh start ceremonies and mm-hmm. ways that we give people an opportunity to start over and feel like they can shed that baggage and shed the negative identity and be more optimistic about what they're going to achieve in the future. I think it's like really fundamentally important to human nature. I have no data to back that up, but it's my sense.
Certainly does seem true. I resonate with that from personal experience. But in what ways can a fresh start be a setback?
Yeah, this is a great question. This is so my brilliant former student, Hengchen Dai, who's now a professor at UCLA's Anderson School, wow. focused on this question. She and I worked on the fresh start studies that I described already. And for her dissertation work, she wanted to look at a situation where she suspected she might be able to study sort of an ugly underbelly of the fresh start effect. The dark side of the fresh start effect. Yes, there are no teeth involved.
Thank goodness. that whole analogy freaked me out. Like, yes. I feel like I'm going to have nightmares
teeth
tonight.
On the fresh start. Yeah, about anyway. Teeth. Yeah, about teeth yeah. and goals. Goals
yes.
with teeth.
Yes.
She was interested in this question. We talked about it a lot before of whether, you know, most of the things that we were studying originally related to fresh starts were sort of goals that most people keep falling down and trying to pick themselves back up and do better on, from going to the gym to starting a diet and so on. But we were thinking, like, what if we could look at a population that was actually really excelling and see if fresh starts are still good? Do you still want a clean slate when you're sort of really doing well? And good the point. Interesting, she studied this in the lab and found that fresh starts, while great for people who are underperforming, are not so great for people who are doing really well because they want to maintain their momentum. And my favorite study she did is actually a study in the field of professional baseball players. And what she found this really cool natural experiment where she looked at players who get traded to a new team in the middle of a league. Excuse me. she looks at players who got traded to a new team in the middle of the season, and she compared two types of trades to have a really beautiful experiment. One was across leagues. So if you get traded across baseball leagues, all of your season-to-date statistics get wiped clean. You don't get to hold on to any of them, and you have to start again. And she compared that to players who are traded within league, who are, again, like moving to a new community. They sort of probably have a sense of a fresh start. So there's a, they both are really similar, but they get to hold on to their season-to-date statistics. So they're not having sort of a reset of their performance. And this was a really nice test because it deals with a lot of issues you'd have if you just looked at people getting traded, like, you know, why were they traded? Were they on a funny trajectory? Will there be regression to the mean? But these are two people, basically otherwise identical records, and they just have different types of trades that they experience. And one gives more of a fresh start than the other. And what she found is consistent with what I just described, that people who were top performers going into this trade and they get traded across leagues, versus within leagues, see a bigger slip in their performance than the people who get traded within leagues and don't have that performance reset. They don't have their record wiped clean. So that sort of wipe clean, clean slate coming with a trade was harmful to people who were doing well. But on the flip side, people who were underperforming, they were having a rough season.
They needed a rough start. I mean, they needed a new start. They needed a new start.
Exactly, exactly. And so I think most of our studies had been to date about people who needed a fresh start. And I think most of us do. We were like, most of us are kind of looking for that in some part of our lives. And so I do think they're probably mostly useful, but that they are something you want to at least approach with care and caution when it's potentially disruptive, right? Like if you're on a roll, I don't think you have to worry about every Monday, because really the benefit of Monday is psychological. It's like that opportunity that you feel to begin again. So I think those kinds of fresh starts are probably not so dangerous. But if you're on a roll and you move to a new job or you move to a new city and your social life had been, you know, doing great and you felt like you had everything in step, like those are the kinds of fresh starts that may not be so good when you're doing well, when they're not purely psychological, they come with some other challenges as well.
This is wonderful nuance.
Thank you.
You must this be is... an academic studying this topic.
I must be an academic. How could you tell?
This is wonderful. This is wonderful, delicious nuance.
That makes me feel like there should be a game show. Like talk to somebody for 15 minutes about a topic that they claim to know a lot about. And then like, you have to guess who's the academic.
I mean,
I think
it's
that
such,
would not be very challenging game show, such, actually.
It's such an academic thing to say, to be like, you know, we didn't realize there was, you know, a control, you know, or we didn't realize there was another condition that when we looked at the condition, we realized that there was more than meets the eye. I mean, like, you know, that's how scholars talk.
Yeah, yes. So we have our own specific, we have our own language and our own it's peculiarities.
Good. It's good.
Most of it's good. There's some parts of it that are.
Oh yeah, there's some.
Yeah, too esoteric.
Yeah, but I mean, in this context, I mean as a compliment, because it's really important with this topic in particular, to not prescribe, like you said, one size fits all. I mean, that this is the point that I think you're bringing such important nuance and, you know, a fresh start to the whole habit literature.
Well, thank you. That's such a nice way of putting it. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, that's true. What is temptation bundling?
Oh, yay. I'm glad we're going to my favorite topic. Temptation bundling is a solution to the worst problem I faced in graduate school, which means actually my graduate school days were not so bad. But my problem in graduate school was that at the end of a long day of classes, I was an engineering student and I would be like just beat from sitting there in computer science classes trying to follow what the heck was going on. And then I had to, you know, turn to my problem sets and I'd get back to my apartment. And all I wanted to do was like, you know, binge watch TV or curl up with a novel and just like totally indulge in, I love fictional content of all kinds. So I wanted to like immerse myself in some other world and have nothing to do with my problem sets. On the other hand, I also knew that to stay motivated and keep my stress under control, I needed to exercise regularly and I could not drag myself to the gym. So I had these two problems. I was wasting time at home on all this entertainment and I wasn't getting the exercises I needed in to stay sane. So I actually came up with a solution for myself that I then ended up studying and other people too, because it worked so well for me. So it was me search. My solution was I only let myself, and I got really into audio novels. I only let myself listen to audio novels while I was exercising. And I like listened to all the Harry Potter novels and all the Alex Cross series and all the Twilight books and all the Hunger Games, you know, all of it only at the gym. And I love this stuff. So I would find myself suddenly coming home at the end of a long day, and all I wanted to do was get to the gym to hear what happened next in my latest thriller. And time would fly at the gym because, you know, I was enjoying what I was listening to. I didn't even notice that I was exercising. I'd come back energized and ready to do my work, and I wasn't going to waste any time at home because I'd gotten my fix of fiction. And it was this sort of marvelous cure for this temptation challenge I'd had before. There were two self-control problems I wasn't winning. And then I came up with this hack that helped me solve them both. So I've since studied this. I've run a couple of experiments showing that this kind of technique, teaching people about it or giving people temptation bundles with exercise, substantially increases their likelihood of going to the gym. Ayelet Fishbach, who's a brilliant professor at the University of Chicago, along with her former student, Caitlin Woolley, who's at Cornell, have done some neat work suggesting it can also help kids be more effective when they're doing math problems if they're able to temptation bundle things that they enjoy, like listening to fun music and working with markers and enjoying snacks they like while they're doing their problem sets. Even though their teachers were very worried that this would be distracting, it actually leads them to persist longer because they're enjoying it. I think this technique can be used in all sorts of different ways. I tell my students about, you know, like, consider only letting yourself pick up your favorite coffee drink that's maybe not super good for you when heading to the library to hit the books, or listening to your favorite podcast while doing household chores. Some people only let themselves drink their favorite red wine while cooking a homemade meal for a family. So there's all different ways that we can temptation bundle. But it all began for me as a graduate student trying to solve these two willpower problems.
I love that. I love that whole concept. That's really going to be helpful for me.
So thank you. It's been really helpful for me.
You really have changed my mind about a lot of things when I was reading your book. And, you know, one topic that is definitely a topic of mutual interest and for both of us is this question: are some people, are they just kind of born with this supernatural self-control capacity? And are some of us not born with that? You know, there's some days I'm wondering, you know, what I was born with, whatever is going on here, I'm wondering what that is all about. But what you kind of dispel that notion a little bit, that's the right way to think about it.
Yeah, well, I should say that everything I know about individual differences I learned from Angela Duckworth, because it's not my area of expertise really at all. I was trained as an engineer. But what Angela tells me, and I'm sure you know this better than I do, is that, yeah, of course, there's some, it seems like there's sort of a genetic component to just about everything, and probably self-control is in that category. But a lot of it is learned, and a huge part of it is strategic, that if we build good habits, if we use creative hacks like temptation bundling, basically to just take self-control out of the picture, those are the people who looked most self-controlled to us, because they're actually not having to exert self-control at all. Another interesting thing Angela told me that has stuck with me is that even if you're self-controlled in one domain of life, it tends not to be highly correlated with self-control in another area, which I'm also resonates with me. I'm really quite self-controlled when it comes to my work, which is probably why Angela seems to think I'm a superhuman. It's much too kind. But like, you know, she hasn't seen necessarily how poorly I can keep my temper with my 5-year-old when he's driving me nuts, right? Like, and so there's other walks, or how much trouble I have resisting like a really delicious chocolate dessert. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of variation in like, where is it? What part of your life? But in general, the point of my book is sort of like, you know, down with exerting self-control and other sort of forms of like superpowers. Like, let's not just say like, I'm never going to forget. I'm always going to exert self-control. I'm always going to have the confidence I need. Like, let's dispel the notion that that's even possible or a good ambition, and instead recognize, okay, these are some things that are hard and that they make change hard. And then let's figure out what are the strategies that science says can actually help us not have to face these demons and be able to overcome them without so much effort.
Yeah, you talk in the book about how you can channel the power of social forces to boost self-control capacity and even self-confidence, dare I say. Like, maybe it's not such a bad thing to boost self-confidence a little bit. What are these social forces that you speak of?
Well, we touched on this a little bit earlier because we were
talking about
conformity.
Oh, yeah.
Related to conformity and the power of, right, the roommate you get assigned and how much that matters. So there's those kinds of social forces, like who you surround yourself with and whether or not they're role models and supporters who make you believe in yourself and show you ways to be sort of a better version of who you want to be. And I will say that, you know, one of the best things in my life actually has been getting to hang around with Angela, because she's a great example of the kind of person. Yeah, exactly. We have that shared luck, good luck, right? Yeah. When you have someone who you spend a lot of time with, who lifts you up because they believe in you and because they're a good role model and they're achieving the kinds of things you want to figure, you know, and you can learn from them and say like, oh, how did you do that? That was really great. And you, that is really powerful. And that's what I primarily mean by social forces. And then we can be thoughtful about who our peers are, try to, especially when we're trying to achieve a goal in particular, try to surround ourselves with other people who have a similar ambition and are maybe a little ahead of us, not so far ahead of us that it's demotivating, which is also important, right? Like if you have an outrageously, far ahead of you type, around, that can be really demotivating, right? Like if you're an entrepreneur and like you hang out with Jeff Bezos all the time, it might not go that well. But someone who's maybe a little bit ahead of you, or a group of people that includes some people who are a little bit ahead of you, that can be really motivating. And you can pick up a lot of insights from being in that company. So that's one thing I mean by social forces.
So what you're saying is choose people and friends who have teeth. Don't hang around British people.
If you want good dental hygiene, hang around other people who have nice teeth. Yes.
That's basically what you're saying.
That's in a nutshell. Yes.
Yeah,
and then
they'll be a good model for you.
Got it.
Can we, for 10 minutes, do some Twitter Q&A? We got a lot of questions on Twitter, but
we did. Some of them were like, oh my gosh, I don't know the answer at all.
Yeah.
big meaning of life type question.
Totally. We only really have time to get to a couple today, but let's, are you okay doing a couple?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
Be kind though. Pick ones that I might have a chance at answering.
For sure. Okay. Let me do that on the spot then. Like Ms. Mo says, can positive behavioral interventions and support help create conditions for meaningful change, or does it make meaningful change more difficult? That's an interesting question, because I wonder like how it could make it more difficult. Sorry, I gave you a difficult question.
You did give me a difficult question. I mean, there's this large, belief out there because of a couple of studies that got a lot of attention, that intrinsic motivation crowd out is this like really awful monster lurking in the closet behind every intervention that you'd ever try to help people, that, you know, that somehow if you've offered a tool or a crutch, people will no longer be motivated once that tool or crutch is removed. In fact, their motivation will crumple and they'll be worse off than they were before. Mm-hmm. So that might be what it means. That's like one idea, just because I hear that a lot, that people get really worried, for instance, about incentives. Mm-hmm. When if you pay people to do something, and a lot of habit researchers will pay people to do something for, say, a month and then remove the payment. And generally what you find is that there's some persistence in the behavior that people were paid to do repeatedly, because there's some kind of habit that forms. Normally it's like, you know, maybe 30% it persists, but it doesn't get wiped away. And there's this fear because of a couple of studies done a long time ago that any kind of reward will extinguish intrinsic motivation. So once it's removed, it'll be a problem. Anyway, so I don't agree with that. And it's generally not what my read of the literature suggests happens. And so I think these kinds of interventions add value rather than having a big downside.
Cool. I hope so.
I hope so too. otherwise, I've been spending my career hurting people.
What are we doing? What else are we doing here? Jim McGee, I thought this was an interesting question. Any findings on willingness or ability to change versus age stage of life? Conventional wisdom is it's harder to change in middle old age, yet we sometimes make major life changes in midlife crises.
Yeah, it's really an interesting question. I don't know a lot about how age relates to ability to change. My funniest age comment on change, which is not an answer to this question, but will make you smile, is that we did find birthdays are a big moment when people are motivated to change. We've seen in multiple dating data sets that people are more likely to create goals around birthdays. They're also more likely to go to the gym at birthdays. But we had one birthday that was a notable exception, actually depressed gym attendance. Every other birthday showed, you know, a positive association. Like after the birthday, people, the same person goes more. 21st birthdays, however, for reasons that listeners will surely appreciate immediately, they're not associated with fresh starts. They're associated with drinking. And so we see gym attendance goes down. It's not an aging question. It's just the only data I have on age that's a little bit amusing. It's a really good question. I don't know if it's true that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. But I'll certainly say that in research studies I have done around habit formation, for instance, when we look at age and see, is it a moderator, meaning like does the effectiveness vary if we just put in age and look at it, we don't tend to see anything, but we don't have 80-year-olds in most of our samples, but in the range of ages that I've often studied, so say 18 to maybe 50 or even 60. I did one big project with 24-hour fitness gyms and we had considerably older participants in that. I do a lot of things on college campuses, so that skews younger. I haven't seen age mattering for how well an intervention works that's designed to help with change.
Wow. Because, I mean, in the personality literature, we know that conscientiousness does show an increase as we age, not decrease, increase. So
maybe that, maybe you get, you know, you build more habits, but you're more conscientious and those things cancel out or something like that. I feel like there's a dissertation to be written here, but
there's something yeah. to be written here. Daniel Chia asks, when, how, and why should we focus our attention and behavior on change rather than acceptance? Now that's a good one. That's a good question.
That is a good one. It's a good one. I will say I'm going to take a cop out answer. One of the things that I struggled with in this book was, you know, should I say anything prescriptive about whether you should change? And I decided that like, that's not my lane. Like my research is really about, okay, I'm going to assume you've decided that you want to change something and I'm going to offer you all the tools and knowledge I can to help. But I don't take a stance on whether you need to change. Okay, let's see if I can say two slightly more thoughtful things about that. I do say at the end of the book, and I very strongly believe this, you know, if something is really not working, right, you're like, you really want to become, you know, you really tried to build a, I keep going to the gym routine. So I'm going to, you stick with the gym example. You really wanted to build a gym routine and it's just like not happening for you that, you know, and you've tried all of the tricks, like literally in my book and it's not working. Like you can't, you've thought you diagnosed the obstacle. It's just, you're not getting there. I think it can be helpful one to like be a little more forgive yourself.
Self-compassion.
Like, yeah, be compassionate to yourself. And then ask yourself, like, what's the higher order goal that I'm going for here? And is there some other way to get there? Like, the gym may not be the thing. Is it that I'm trying to be healthier? Is it that I want to be fit? What is it? And like, is there some other path to that goal that I could take? And maybe I should like take a different route because this route isn't working. So that this may just not be an end that's going to happen for me. So if the gym is just never going to work for you, is it like, well, maybe there's another, maybe like you should join a club soccer team and that would get you to your goal. Or maybe you don't care as much about physical fitness as you do about health and you could take up meditation or improve your sleep habits or your diet. And there's some other way again to achieve it that might be more feasible to fit within your life. So I do think, you know, if you've tried everything and whatever it is you set out as your goal isn't there, like rethinking? Do you have the right goal? What's the superordinate goal? And can you get there some other way is really important.
I really like that. Thank you for like taking the time to actually think that through and offer a good one. Because I'm really interested in humanistic psychology, and like Carl Rogers talked a lot about acceptance as, his quote is, "The curious paradox is that once I've accepted myself, then I can change." That's his quote.
That is a curious paradox. And actually, I should use that quote. It's such a wonderful quote for the book, right? Because the book basically says, once you accept that there are these obstacles and figure out, you know, like, and have the self-awareness to figure out which one is blocking you, that is what allows you to change. So there has to be that degree of self-awareness and acceptance, as opposed to just believing I'm a superhuman and I can like pummel through any problem.
Exactly. Exactly. I'll send you the exact quote. I think I got it 100% right, but I'll double check. It's one of my favorite quotes. Ethan,
you might see it on Twitter attributed to you as the source who taught me.
I'd be honored if you quoted Carl Rogers and attributed it to me, or attributed the source to you, not the quote. You know what I mean?
Here's the quote, and here's the person who gave me this great quote.
Okay, last question. I want to be respectful of your time, but I think it's kind of a funny question. Ethan says, entirely selfish question, what behavioral changes makes one a better academic?
Oh, wow.
How do you apply it within that domain?
Well, okay, actually, I'm like, oh, this one's easy. I thought it was hard, and now I'm like, oh, no, it's not. It's not hard. Okay, and we haven't talked about this, so it's one of my favorite topics in the book, and it's so well-suited to academia. So, Lauren Eskris Winkler, who is one of Angela Duckworth's doctoral students. Yeah, another mutual friend, had this brilliant insight. And I got to work with her a little bit on research on this topic that we so often when someone is struggling to achieve a goal, we sort of put our arm around them and give them some advice. And that can be really demotivating and demoralizing. And that a better way to help people might actually be to ask them for advice. Because people generally are actually, she discovered in conducting many interviews, even if they're struggling to achieve a goal, they're often quite sophisticated about some things that might help. And it's a matter of having the self-confidence and the motivation to actually take action on those insights or even dredge them up. So if you're asked to help someone else, you're going to feel more confident. Okay, like someone believes in me, I must be able to do this. You're going to come up with insights that maybe you wouldn't have been motivated to dredge up if you'd just been thinking about yourself. And once you sort of say them to someone else and you're in this position of a role model, you're going to feel like a hypocrite if you don't actually take action on them yourself. So I think this is a really powerful insight. And I actually think it can help academics tremendously. We're already in the business of teaching, but I actually think the thing that has improved me the most and made my career both most fulfilling and frankly advanced it in terms of the sort of objective stuff like publications and accomplishment has been mentoring great students. When you mentor other people and you teach them the tools of the trade, you actually learn yourself more than you appreciate, and it builds up your confidence and helps you recognize some of the consistent and most important sort of rules and patterns in achieving and doing good science. And so I think mentoring is probably like the best thing. And mentoring, you know, with your whole heart in it is probably the best thing that you can do as an academic if you want to make more of yourself in that domain.
Yeah, with genuine intentions. Yeah.
Yes.
That's great. Great advice. Great advice. Thank you for being good sport and answering the Twitter questions. You never know what you're going to get with the Twitter questions. There are a lot that I saved you from.
Okay, thank you for that.
Katie, thank you so much for being on the podcast today and for being such a bright light in our entire field. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And likewise to you. Thank you for making this amazing podcast, and thank you for having me on it.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, if you'd prefer a completely ad-free experience and would like early access to new episodes, you can join us at patreon.com/psychpodcast. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.